Hello, and welcome to the new Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Frame.io. My name is Steve Hallfish. I'm a feature film and documentary editor. For more than 7 years, over 300 interviews, I've been speaking with my colleagues in film, TV, and docs about the art and craft of editing. Today, we're speaking with Oscar nominee Pamela Martin, ACE, the editor of the film King Richard, starring Will Smith as the father of tennis greats Venus and Serena Williams. Ms. Martin was nominated for an Ace Eddie for Little Miss Sunshine and was nominated for another Ace Eddie and an Oscar for The Fighter. Her other films include Downhill, Battle of the Sexes, and Free State of Jones. She's also cut TV, including the TV series Weeds. If you're interested in reading this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to blog.frame.io, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. I noticed that you've done a bunch of sports movies. Obviously, you were nominated for an Oscar for The Fighter. And then you've also cut another tennis movie. Are you getting pigeonholed? Like, I've heard editors say, they're pigeonholing me. I get all the tennis movies.
I mean, my doing the tennis movie sort of had nothing to do with The Fighter. But I must say, after The Fighter, every single boxing movie crosses my desk. And also after that one, I got a lot more macho fare. Right? Because before that, I was doing almost all dark comedies. And once I did that, I got called for dramas and anything with fighting in it, whether it was boxing or other kind of fighting or cops or, you know, gunfights. And Battle of the Sexes came about because I'd done Dayton Ferris's other two films. And then I landed on this one. And actually, Ray told me that the reason he called me on this one was that he felt like two of his references for King Richard were Little Miss Sunshine and The Fighter. And I look at all of the three sports movies as not sports movies. I mean, they're dramas with sports in them. A lot of people are very interested in the sports part of it because it's kind of hard to do, but I look at them as family dramas or character dramas.
Yeah, you wouldn't call Little Miss Sunshine a pageant movie.
No, but trust me, I've gotten a lot of pageant scripts too. And it's hard to want to gear up to do that sort of thing again. You know, anytime you do a film that you love or just you've done a film, it's a long journey. You don't really want to jump back in with similar material again. And I was hesitant to do this one because of the tennis, but we did the tennis in a completely different way than Battle of the Sexes. So that made it very interesting to me. And honestly, I took the job because I really like Ray. I'd met him years before, and I thought the script was great. I love the story.
You probably get a little bit more chance to be picky. What are some of your criteria other than trying not to make it be like the last one?
Well, it all comes down to the script. I mean, the script is the primary thing. It's interesting to sort of think about why I pick scripts well. And I think it's because I pick scripts that of movies that I want to see, with some exception. You know, sometimes you do a job for money, sometimes you do a job because you have a long relationship with a particular director and they ask you to do it. But for the most part, I think it's a level of taste. I just pick what I want to see because I'm the one who has to sit there sometimes for a year, you know, 9 months, a year, 15 months. And I better really, really love what I'm doing or it can be pretty torturous. And then of course the director factors into it as well. Their level of experience is often an indicator of whether or not I want to get involved in the project. I look at myself as like the mother of the movie. And if I have to mother too much, I already have my own kids at home, you know. So I really have to like their prior work. And Ray, this is only his third feature, but I loved Of Monsters and Men, which was his first film. And I had the opportunity to see that before I got on board with this one. And also, you just have to see if you're going to click with the director because you spent a lot of time together.
Are you still even doing in-person meetings anymore? I mean, when you met with Ronaldo?
Yeah, well, I met Ray probably about 5 years ago at the Sundance Filmmakers Lab when he was workshopping Of Monsters and Men. I was just there for a week, as was Bob Elswit, his DP on this movie. And he came to me maybe about 5 months before the film was up and running and ready to go. And he just said, I would love to talk to you about my film. So he sent me the script and we got together over breakfast and talked about it. And I asked him a lot of questions about how he was planning on doing the tennis, because I knew what the pitfalls were, having done it before. And I just wanted to sort of see what his plan was for it. And we talked about the characters and maybe, you know, a typical meeting, I might point out things in the script that could be better or maybe that are unnecessary before they shoot. So we sort of talk about the script. And then we sort of left it alone. And months passed and he came back to me again and said, well, it's happening. Are you in? And between the time that I first met him and the call months later, when he said, are you in or not, I had had the opportunity to read a lot of other scripts that were coming in looking for editors. And it was by far the best script I had read. So I decided that I would be foolish not to take it. And it really spoke to me on many levels. And so I said, yes. And then from there, you know, we talked probably more about the script, and there were previs shoots. You know, there's a previs shoot for the tennis to help determine what angles were working best with the style that he wanted to use. And so that was very, very helpful. So by the time they went and shot the tennis, we'd already determined these are the types of angles that work. This coverage does not work. This is why. We'd already, you know, I'd already put all these various tests together. So that was helpful prior to the shooting, the principal photography.
One of the questions I ask a lot of editors and get such varied responses is about your approach. When you are looking at a blank timeline, when you are looking at a fresh bin of dailies, what do you do?
When I get the dailies, I sit down and I watch everything. And I take handwritten notes, pieces that I like, takes that don't work. And they're just little notes. I have a huge thick notebook full of handwritten notes for every movie, every single take and angle. If they're shooting multiple cameras and it's not handheld, I am able to watch multiple cameras at the same time and take notes on those performances. And by doing that process, I familiarize myself with all the angles. And sometimes I have a very clear idea of, I love this shot for the beginning of the scene, or I must use this piece in the middle or for this area, etc. But mostly when I start to cut, I don't do any string outs. I hate them. I've never ever done them, and I find it very counterintuitive to my process. I go right into what I call a rough cut, not an assembly, but a rough cut. And I don't overthink where I'm beginning the scene, where I start the scene. Sometimes it's very obvious because I see a really beautiful shot that would work well as a transition. And obviously you're cutting the film out of order, so you often don't have the scene that came before or that comes after. But I just pick a spot because I know it could change. It's probably going to change. It doesn't really matter. And I go on a ride with the scene is how I would describe it. Whatever angle I decided to start with, I look through my notes. This was my favorite one I see in my notes. And so I start there. And I don't cut until my eye wants to see the next thing. So if I'm cutting a conversation and I really want to see that person's reaction, that's when I'll cut. And I will then go to those close-ups and look through my notes, and I just shape the scene as I go. I also used to be a dialogue editor back in my early days, and I do a lot of smoothing out as I'm cutting the initial scene, because I know that if it bumps at all, the cut will bump. And it will bump the director on first viewing. So I do a lot of dialogue work as I go, just smoothing everything out. And if that means I'm pre-lapping or post-lapping, that's what I do. I even do line replacements when necessary if I'm having difficulty matching mics or matching performances. So when I finish a first pass, I have something that's semi-polished, and it's also pretty quick because I'm trying to keep up with camera, so I'm speed editing. And I often will cut multiple versions because I might see another approach to it and want to try that as well and give the director maybe two or three ways that I did that. I always tell all my young editor friends, this has been something that I figured out over many years how to do, how to make sure the director feels connected with the edit during production. I'll send an email to the director and I'll go in sequential order and I'll say scene three with a little one-line description of what that scene is. I roughed this scene together today. It's working really well, especially the comedy when they do this. I might say, I had a little trouble with this one performance. They seem a little stiff or it wasn't quite what I expected, that sort of thing. Some directors also want to talk to me every evening and sort of download their day and say like, I did all these scenes and I just want you to know that my favorite take was this. In general, I don't pay that much attention to the circle takes because I find that the perception of how things play on set is often quite different than how they play on the screen. That's why I watch everything and take notes on everything and cut it to my specifications or to my liking.
You mentioned that you keep notebooks of these notes that you have, but you also, I'm sure, are using markers in the clips. Why write stuff down instead of just using markers?
My system for my markers are very specific. I use the marker to notate usable pieces of each take and what's garbage stuff in between. I use markers also to indicate pickups within a take. The only time that I fully mark up takes with markers, because it gets very busy visually for me, is when I have ad-libs. And I have my assistants put every single line into the markers for the ad-lib so that I basically can open up a page of them to my left and it's the script of what was said. I can usually find things that way. And the handwritten notes, I do write time codes in to my handwritten notes and I can just punch that time code in and find that spot. I just like to keep it very clean because I want to be able to see where the starts and stops are and where the pickups are. It's kind of sort of separating the visuals of that.
Totally understand. And do you even refer back to notes? Like a lot of times, I think people take notes as a way of memorizing something instead of as a way of looking back at something.
Yes, it definitely helps for memorizing. It helps on the very first cut. I go back to them on occasion, but I don't heavily rely on them. If I have documentary style footage, I use it a lot more. And I also have a system where I star things, one star, two star, three stars, whatever. And that's all in my handwritten notes, mostly. Sometimes the handwritten notes are helpful to find a particular angle because I cut in frame view. And sometimes the frame view is flipped or there's three or four angles. And sometimes it's hard to see which one was which angle. So I'll go back to my note to find that.
When you work with a new director like Ray, how do you make him comfortable with your decisions? How do you start that relationship?
I think when I started with Ray, there obviously was a level of comfort to begin with because I had already spent some time with him at the Sundance Lab. But I also think because of my level of experience compared to his, there's also a level of comfort. He knows he's hiring somebody who knows what they're doing. Hopefully. But like I said, those notes that I send every day and the cuts that I send increase their confidence because I am sort of the cheerleader that's seeing everything. They're not seeing everything. They're too busy shooting the movie. The producers haven't even seen everything. They're too busy managing the movie. And so I'm the one person who's hands-on with what he's producing every day. So the more conversation I can have with him, the more I can show him, they will feel like they're in good hands. I hope they look to the edit room and say, she's got this. And she's helping me because she's giving me good critiques and also letting me know what's really working. And I do that either on the phone or in my emails or both. And I think they can see that in the cut material. I was on one job where the producer called me at one point and said, oh my God, the director just waits for those emails every evening. It's just like the highlight of their day. I feel like, you know, you get a rapport going. And I used to not do that. And I've had directors question my level of engagement. I got the sense that I wasn't giving them quite enough. And that's what prompted me to sort of step it up and just be very proactive. And I think it really, really help in so many ways with the relationship and with how they feel on set about what they're doing, and that they feel more confident about what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's interesting that we live in a kind of different era now that, you know, when we were cutting on film or even before emails and texts, right? The only way that you could do that stuff was to kind of get in the director's face.
When I was cutting on film, the PA would pick me up at the edit room, whatever time they wrap, it could be 11 o'clock at night, and drive me to sometimes to location an hour away to sit in a trailer to screen dailies. And it was exhausting. Yes, they have you in the room, you're sitting next to them, they're saying, I like this, I like that, and you're taking their notes. But honestly, for me, it was such a waste of time because I watched everything every single day. And it just expanded my day by hours sometimes. And I couldn't fully take my notes the right way because I had to have my ear open for the director sitting next to me to take their notes. I didn't have the ability to show them cuts unless they came in. They were more in the dark, as were you, because until they looked at the cuts, you didn't know if you were on the right track. And I had an experience very early in my career where I went up to set to show 2 weeks worth of work. And the funny part of the story is that I looked at the takes and it wasn't clear from the script notes what the director liked or didn't like. I saw a progression in the takes. It was a comic drama. And I noticed that as the takes went on, usually the last couple of takes, the comedy got a lot more broad. And then they would stop filming. Without a conversation with the director, one might surmise that this is what they were going for. And they finally got it in the last one or two takes. So I cut the scenes more broad. I got to Canada and sat down with the director, and he was horrified. He actually gave those takes to the actor. The actor really wanted to do that. And so he would just get what he needed and then say, okay, go do your thing. And it was a very experienced actor, but I didn't know this. He didn't tell me this. And I just guessed based on my experience, which was more limited at that time. The producer who I'm still friends with today is very funny. She said, he wanted to fire you. He wanted to fire you after that weekend, but I went back and very quickly recut everything, you know, sent something in the mail after that. It just goes to show you that if you don't communicate well, you could totally go down the wrong path.
Right. And if it had, and it would have been worse if you hadn't gone up there after 2 weeks, because then you would have done 6 months of work or 4 months of work.
And... yeah. I so wish that the script supervisor or the director had told me that. To say, hey, just so you know.
That brings up an interesting point. How close of a relationship do you try to develop with the script supervisor?
That's a tough question. I mean, I mostly talk to the script supervisor about what is needed that we didn't get. Sometimes you're trying to figure out where a new scene could go. But in those cases, you're mostly talking to the writer instead and the director. I don't communicate a lot with them because if you have a good script supervisor, the notes are quite excellent. They communicate more with me to make sure they're giving me what I need. More of the conversations are about pickup shots. There's also the times where the producers come to you and say, we don't have time for all this. What do you really need?
Tell me about your sense of stewardship of this story because it's a true life story. Did you feel a special responsibility?
Absolutely. I think anytime you tell a story about real people, you have a responsibility to be as truthful as possible about it. On this film, we had Esha Price, one of the older sisters in the Williams family, as an executive producer, and she was on set every day. And she also watched the cuts that we showed the producers and gave notes. And then she was very important because sometimes she would say, oh, that would never happen. We couldn't have that scene because in our house, these characters would never speak this way about their father, for example. I love stories about real people because the stories to me seem more incredible than fiction a lot of the time.
Talk to me about how you and Ray felt dialed into the POV of Richard. How did that affect the editing or the story decisions that you were focused on his perspective and not the girls, maybe?
King Richard is the origin story for Venus and Serena. And at one point in the movie, the torch is passed to Venus. In the edit, We had an issue in the first act of the film, in the first scripted version that was cut. And we knew we had all these great pieces, but the order of it wasn't quite right. We kept changing the opening. The opening was never really fully fleshed out in a way. And we kept being told we would find it in the edit, or we would go again, pick up shots, we'll figure out what it is. And so where we landed, the movie that you see, the first act has a lot of scenes that have been reordered. And we even tried removing things and just starting on the streets of Compton. Everything we tried wasn't quite working. And then Ray and I had the idea to move this coat shopping, combine it with the collecting balls. And it immediately puts the film in his voice, in his point of view. You see him getting rejected over and over and over. When we saw how the effect of having those scenes up front, how tired he looked at that job, was so much more impactful. And then he still opens the tennis magazine and finds another coach. He does not give up. And it really helped launch the movie in Richard, or King Richard's point of view, from the very opening. And that was created in the editing process. Point of view was crafted very deliberately throughout the film. There's a very simple scene early in the film when Richard's taken them to the courts the first time, and the gangster beats him up a little bit. We get back in that car with him in the van, and I hold on the girls, looking scared, totally silent, completely the opposite of what it was like on the drive to the court. And then one sister pipes in and says, "Daddy, are you okay?" And then we just hold on Richard, giving his little talk about, you know, ain't nobody ever had no respect for Richard Williams, but they're going to respect y'all. I did not cut. We are experiencing Richard and why he feels the way he does, what he's trying to help the girls with in life. You really experience his headspace, where he is, what he's thinking.
It's so interesting that so much of the beginning of the film was restructured. I think of it as a very linear story, but I only watched it once. But you're right, the beginning is not linear. And was the end of the movie as scripted?
There actually was another scene between Richard and Rick Macy in the hallway about take the deal, please take the deal. You know, another one of those scenes. And it was a beautiful scene because Rick said to Richard, "I know I don't say this to you often enough, but you are a great father." There was a little more of an exchange where Richard got a little angry at him, at Rick. But Rick says, "Look, you are a great father, but you need to do this." The final act just couldn't hold the weight of all this. And it was a scene we loved, but we had one too many scenes of that beat. But one interesting thing that came about during production was the scene with Richard and Serena looking out at the large court where he says, "I have a plan for you." That scene was not scripted there. There was another scene where the family left for the airport, and in the script, Serena was not coming down, and Dad goes up to the bedroom to have a talk with her. The day they shot it, they were super rushed, and they did not have time to stage that in this bedroom. So they shot a scene in the stairwell. Unfortunately, it was a very tight space, so we were just sort of at these kind of odd angles. It just visually, it didn't work. And because it was so rushed, the performances didn't even really work. The scene didn't work. And it's funny because when I get a little bit behind in the dailies, I often give scenes to my assistants who want to cut it. I look at the coverage and I give them simple scenes. And I gave that particular scene to one of the assistant editors. He was taking a long time with it. Finally, I got to the point where it's like, I need the scene now because I got to give it to the director. And I looked at it, I was like, wow, this scene is kind of a mess. I didn't know if it was because he had edited it that way or if it really was a mess. So I went back through the dailies and I cut the best scene I could out of it, but it's just a stinker. Coincidentally, that day, one of the producers called me and said, "How's everything going?" And I said, "Yeah, it's going great. Everything's looking good. But I must say, I finally hit a scene that just doesn't work at all. And I have very high hopes for this scene in the script. It's a really important scene, but it's just not working." And I want to say that the producer said, "Was it the scene between Richard and Serena?" You know, like they kind of knew deep down, like it was rushed and it's, And I said, "Yes, it just doesn't work at all. Please tell me we can reshoot this." By that time, they'd wrapped the location. So so then we got into a deep discussion, Ray and I and the writer and the producers, where could this scene go? The only place we could do it at that point was once we got to Oakland. So with a lot of back and forth, they finally said, okay, we found a spot. You're looking down the court. Now, by virtue of removing that extra scene with Rick Macy and Richard in the hallway, that's sort of how that scene got placed where it is. And it is just at the perfect moment. It's the sweet spot for that scene. Some of it was a happy accident. And obviously it was a kind of a happy accident that it was messed up in the first place. But that scene is just in the perfect place for the storytelling. And once she wins that first match, we don't see that stadium with Venus first. We see it with Serena, and she has been sort of left behind to some extent, and she's looking out at it, and Richard finds her and has that moment with her. It's so beautiful and it's so impactful. You see how much she's yearning to be the person going on to that center court. It just couldn't have worked out better.
How do you determine what is in your storytelling brain as an editor that says this scene with Rick's got to go, or some other scene has got to go when it's scripted?
Sometimes I can tell when I'm doing the first cut, where I see very clearly a thread that could be followed that makes perfect sense without the stuff in between. Sometimes I take out a scene during the first cut, I'll show it to them and I'll show it to them without it. In the case of the third act in this film, when we watched the whole movie together, it was evident that the last act was just too much. It was too fat. And it was very clear to me that that particular scene, or one of those two scenes with Rick, had to go. I feel like once you get the whole movie together, some of it is very obvious. And then other times it's not so obvious. Sometimes you drop scenes and you put them back. That happens all the time. It happened in this movie. The Nancy Reagan scene. It was a longer scene. And in the scene, another agent comes up and Paul Cohen introduces this agent to Richard. And he sort of tees up the next scene by saying, "Your girls were incredible." Kind of plants that word in his head a little bit earlier. It's a weird exchange where the guy's like, "Yeah, we can make a lot of money." And Richard's not sure what to make of this guy. That got cut quite early. But we decided at one point, like, what would it be if we didn't have that Nancy Reagan scene? What was so interesting to me was when I played that section without that scene, the scene with the agent did not work at all. His reaction in that scene did not work because you didn't know fully why Richard was as pissed off as he was from the beginning of that exchange with the agent. And it became evident to me when it was gone why it needed to be there. What was important was Richard's POV, again, about where did these kids come from? All these Black kids, they're clearly bussed in from somewhere else for a photo op for the former First Lady. And so by having his kids part of this photo op for a politician after the Rodney King beating and before meeting these guys who are like, "Let us take it from here. We can do better for your daughter," was so important to get in Richard's headspace for why he was so difficult in that meeting. And just taking a small thing like that out really changed it.
And that's why a lot of editors, I don't know whether you've ever done them, but a slash and burn, where you try to cut the film down as tight as you can, and then you realize the things you miss.
You're always trying to do the most economical version of the movie without sacrificing essential character development and your drama and your story arcs. And yeah, it's like a house of cards. You remove too many and the film falls apart, or a whole section might not work.
Well, thank you so much for a really excellent discussion. And I learned a lot, and hopefully a lot of other people will learn from the things that you said. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks, you too.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, these interviews are also available to read at blog.frame.io, where they're supported with great visual content, images, video clips, and more. It's a great opportunity to check out the other expert content on the blog for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven, curated look at the craft of editing. And be on the lookout for our upcoming video interview with a legendary editor, Paul Hirsch, ACE, on our YouTube channel. Thanks to my guest, Pamela Martin, ACE. Thanks to Dylan Giovanetto for editing today's podcast using Adobe Audition. And thanks to Frame.io for their support of Art of the Cut and its pledge to keep this content coming your way. If this is a podcast that you got something out of, follow me and feel free to reach out to me on Twitter and Instagram at Steve Hullfish. And so you don't miss out on all the great upcoming interviews on the Art of the Cut podcast, subscribe to this podcast. And remember that if you have a friend in the film business or who aspires to be in the film business, make sure to tell them about the Art of the Cut podcast and blog.frame.io.